on Next Snap Judgment. From PRX and NPR, The Guide. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Stay tuned. This Snap Judgment podcast is supported by MailChimp. More than 5 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to send email newsletters, and MailChimp also distributes hats for cats and small dogs. More at MailChimp.com. Okay, so I moved to Japan to attend the first year of a very, very, very small school. One of our professors was this guy, Teramoto-sensei. And Teramoto-sensei is a badass in every way it is possible to be a badass. He's respected as one of the top Japanese art historians in the world, studied as a fifth Dan black belt, which in lay terms means that once you get your regular black belt, you haven't even begun to contemplate dreaming about a fifth Dan. In fact, they'll kick you in the teeth for even saying it. Anyway, he's cool. He's got this in-depth knowledge of Japanese culture and teaches me basic forms of etiquette. Glenn, don't just stick your chopsticks in a bowl of rice. That means you're offering food to the departed. Glenn, pour your beer holding the bottle with two hands. It shows respect. Remember, you represent your school. We represent each other. He spoke of the way of the samurai, of the Bushido code, the way to die with honor so that one training in the Bushido, when falling off a mountain, they will not scream, but only accept their fate, while someone untrained will holler and yell, even though there's nothing to be done. The problem was that Teramoto-sensei taught Japanese art history, where we'd go into a dark room. A student volunteer operated a slide projector, while Teramoto-sensei showed us slides of statues and temples and paintings, and it usually took me 5 or 10 minutes at the most before I was fast asleep. Gen-san, nani shite no? I wake up quick, try to play it off, wipe the drool from off the side of my face. I'd vow to do better. Next day, back to the slides. We'd stare at pictures of old Buddhist statues, and we had to learn what the various hand gestures symbolized. Or something or another. One finger up meant the first incarnation of the ways of the thing that went around. And there I was, asleep again in Teramoto's class. Gursa! Nani kore? And because every day I'd fall asleep in class, no matter what I did, it embarrassed me to see Teramoto-sensei out of class. But I loved him outside of class. He'd say stuff like, what would you rather be, a snowball or a rock? And I didn't know, and I wanted to find out, and I wanted him to like me. And one day he said something like, the real student will find a way to climb the mountain. And I just knew he was speaking to me. How could I find a way to climb the mountain? Finally, I understood that I would dive into the eye of the storm. I would volunteer to be the person turning the slides, for then, only then would I stay awake. I asked him, may I operate the projector? He looks at me for a long while, then nods. And I take over, determined. I wait for instruction. I hold the slide clicker in my hand. Teramoto-sensei commences the lecture. This statue is from the Heian period, right? Next slide, please. I click. This one is from the Edo period. Also tires, like kryptonite. Next slide, please. Click. This is from the Muromachi period. Next slide. Next slide, please. Next slide, someone smacked me upside the head. Even holding the clicker didn't work. I was fast asleep, no matter how hard I tried. I see him after class and he tells me, "The cat that runs into the fire will never get stuck." What? The water tastes the mountain and the mountain tastes the water. And I promised him that I would think on that, which I did. For several years, I contemplated. I thought hard on everything he had taught me. I finished school, I got a job, I had experiences. And one day, living in Ann Arbor, I saw a poster that the great man himself would be giving a lecture at the art school. I gathered up my fellas, and when Teramoto Sensei came out on stage, there were five of us, former students, sitting in the front row. He looked down at us, and I saw real joy in his eyes. I saw it. He nodded. We nodded back. Then he proceeded with his lecture, and he dimmed the light to show some slides. I fell asleep. Afterwards, when we took him out to eat, I had to ask him, what was all that stuff about? Why did the lion dance in winter? How does the wind smell the grasshopper? What were you trying to teach us? Teach you? He laughed and laughed. Teach you? Glenn, I just wanted you to have nice dreams. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present The Guide. The Guide. Amazing stories from real people taking us where we need to go. My name is Glenn Washington. Please hold my hand as I do not want you to fall off. Because this is Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off today's Snap Judgment episode across the pond. And sensitive listeners should know that while this story is not graphic, it does allude to dark events.
I wake up by myself in a hospital bed. Everything around me is strange. But the next thing that happens is an hysterical woman who is running around the bed, screaming and shouting, getting very overexcited, and is saying, "Do you remember me? Do you remember me? It's me. I have no idea who she is. Never seen her before. So I get quite distressed by her actions, and they have to ask her to leave the room.
Alex Lewis has just woken up from a week-long coma from a terrible motorcycle accident.
I see one person, and I immediately recognise that he's my twin brother. So at that point, I'm feeling quite calm. And I say hello, Marcus, to him, and he says hi back to me. And then Marcus keeps saying to me, "Don't you know who that is? That's your mother." I said, "No, I don't know who she is." And he said, "Well, do you know who you are?" And I said, "No." He now realises I don't know anything at all, even who I am, how to walk, ride a bicycle, my work, my girlfriend, my family, everything is gone. I didn't even know my name.
The first 18 years of Alex's life have vanished. He can barely walk or talk. At first, this was terrifying.
But with having the confidence of having my twin brother with me didn't worry me. I had that massive security. I start asking him, what did we used to do? What was our childhood like? He would tell me, we used to have great dinner parties at home. We'd eat with our parents all the time. Lots of people come round, going on family holidays in the south of France. These were the start of him filling me in on my idyllic childhood. My mother and my brother eventually come to take me home. We arrive. It's quite a large house, 2 hours outside of London. As I enter the house, I meet this much older gentleman who turns out to be my stepfather, who's incredibly formal and just shakes my hand and introduces himself. No hugging, no nothing. My mother seems to be completely opposite and just very, very loud, very, very out there. So I took that on board. I then meet my younger siblings, Amanda and Oliver, who at this point are only 3 and 5.
Alex learns to adapt to his family and tries to pick up where he left off prior to the accident, being an 18-year-old teenager. Marcus is there every step of the way. He teaches Alex how to drive, takes him to parties, and acts as his wingman.
We would always go out together. If we went to a new person's house, we'd get to the door, and then I would repeatedly ask him, what are their names? How do I know this person? You know, have I gone out with this person, this girl, or haven't I, or everything? So we'd have a quick little chat, and then bang, you'd go in and then start talking to people. I learned very quickly how to just adjust without people realising that I had really no idea who they were, but they knew me very well, and I could continue just flow on in a conversation.
He was able to cope without having a memory, but he still wanted the keys to his past.
I did spend quite a lot of time going to see all sorts of people, from hypnotherapists to doctors to memory specialists. Nothing ever worked, and I never, ever got anything back. So as I had my brothers, he gave me back my memory. So I gave up, and I just stopped asking questions, so I didn't really search. After a while, the amnesia, that didn't define me as a person, but I still had a niggling feeling inside of something and of not being able to connect 100% with people. I always knew that there was something amiss, but I could never work out what it was.
12 years go by, and while Alex's memory never returned, his brother always stood by his side.
We're coming up for my 30th birthday, and our mum, traditionally, would always take us out on our birthday, so we were waiting for her to take us to a fancy restaurant in London. She's late. My brother then has a premonition at this point, which is a very strange thing to do. Well, it was for me, and said he felt that something was wrong and that she was collapsed and she was lying at the bottom of the stairs in her house. And I said, how could you possibly know that? So we called the doctor, and they saw her car open outside the door, front door open, and they went and found her, and sure enough, she was lying at the bottom of the stairs. Turns out that she'd had a brain hemorrhage, and she'd had a fit, and she was lying at the bottom of the stairs. And then they basically told us that she would live for 12 months, and she lived for 12 months, pretty much exactly as they said. We were all present when she died, and I was very upset that she'd gone. I had an overwhelming feeling, even though I was never that close to her, maybe I just learnt that that's what you did. So I just felt emotionally upset to the point of crying and everything else that she had gone. And it's only at this point that I notice that everyone else in the room, my siblings, were not. They weren't crying over her death. They had what I could clearly see was a relief that she had died. And I'm thinking, hang on a sec, our mother's just died. Is nobody bothered about that? And they just said, no, we're not. That was a shock. Something wasn't right. And that's when I started to question the whole of our life, really. The whole of our house, the whole of our family. From there, some time went on, so I just basically pushed that strange thought to the back of my mind.
After the funeral, Alex and his siblings start going through their mother's belongings.
We would come down every weekend and start sorting it out, which in a way was like a treasure hunt. And we would just open drawers and find things. We were finding £50 notes, you know, under floorboards, stacked in drawers, and so the hunt was on. We then opened another drawer and then contained all of our birthday cards with all of the money that had ever been given to us throughout our childhood. Another cupboard had every single Easter egg we'd ever been given, but it had never been given to us. She'd kept them all. And I'm thinking that this is all beginning a bit odd. And then we get into her bedroom. And then in the back of the wardrobe, there's another secret wardrobe. And we find a key and we open it. And we look inside and there's just loads of, I don't know how to describe it really. It was basically sex toys and stuff that you, at that age, you just, from your, it's your mother's, you really don't want to deal with that. And then we get into her writing desk and we start finding letters, love letters from lots of people, from all sorts of different men, not from our father. And then that's when we find the naked picture of me and my twin brother, aged 12, with our heads cut off. My mind is going round in whirls, and I'm starting to question what the hell's going on. There must be secrets within this family that I don't know about and that I haven't been given the full story. And that's the first time that I started challenging my siblings to what everything was about. Why were we never given a front door key to our own house? Why were we never let in unless we were allowed to be there? And no one would say anything. Complete silence. I start questioning my brother about it, and he just puts it all down to, it's not a big deal. Maybe she was a little bit crazy, and let's just move on. We've got other things to deal with. So he just belittled all of it to the point of me stop thinking about that it was strange. So once we finished the house and everything, soon after that, my younger brother announces that he's going into therapy. And for me, that's like, well, why would we do that? We've had quite an idyllic life and parents were a bit eccentric. Then my twin brother then announces he's also going into therapy, which I thought was strange. And I thought, okay, we've lost both our parents. We're all quite young. I could see why they would need to do that. So I decided to go myself as well.
Individually, they all go to the same therapist, but Alex didn't get much out of it. While he could sense something was wrong, his siblings never talked about family problems, and his therapist couldn't reveal confidential information. So Alex turns to another therapist named Vivian, who invites him to one of her group sessions.
We spent the whole weekend talking about everyone's problems. I didn't really see where this was going at all. And then we started talking about our childhood. Of course, I wasn't contributing much to that because I didn't have any. And then something snapped. I'm crying uncontrollably. I have no idea why I'm doing that. Something's triggered in me, completely just snapped. I sit down, and then in a flash of an instant second, I then just pass out and leave my body. And I'll never forget this. I had this experience of arriving on the other side of the room and watching my lifeless body on the floor, and all the people are going, like, running around. And then Vivian came in, took control of the situation, and then just sat down and put her hands along me and said, "You're going to come back, and you're going to come back now." And she pulled me back into my body, and I looked at her and I said, "What was that about?" And then she said, "There's a bit more to your life than you knew. And you've been sexually abused by your family." And I just couldn't believe it. And I was like, no, you've got this wrong. This hasn't happened. I said, "You're making a mistake. You can't just say a statement like that." She said, "I am making that statement, and it's true, and it's your mother." I said, no, that's wrong. She said, "You need to go home, and you need to talk to your siblings seriously about this problem." I said, "I will be doing that, but I still don't believe you." The next day, I went and to my twin brother's house, and my brother was in the kitchen.
I was standing in my house, and Alex came in, and I'd had a perfectly nice day, and I was feeling rather happy and chirpy.
I said to him, "I've just been on this workshop." I said, "This is what Vivian said. She said this extraordinary statement to me. How can this be true? Tell me it's not." And he had a cup of tea in his hand. He looked me in the eye, and he just went white as a ghost.
The blood drained out of me. I mean, it was the one thing that I never really thought was ever going to happen.
And I said, "Is it true? Yes or no?" I got quite cross with him. And he just said,
"Well, Alex, I really don't know how to describe it, but I'm really sorry to say, but it is true, yes." And then I had to leave the room and go outside because I was freaking out.
I'm just thinking, this is crazy. My whole life has just suddenly changed in one day. I've gone from fairly normal to thinking there's something strange going on to absolute turmoil.
I'm starting to question the rest of my life and everything Marcus has told me and what is true and what isn't true. The holidays we went on, did they happen? The people coming around for dinner parties, did that happen? And I'm just thinking, is everything a lie?
I found myself standing in the garden trying to work out whether I'd done the right thing, whether I should have told him years before, and feeling waves of guilt that maybe I had done the wrong thing and had never really anticipated that he would ever find out.
I then challenged my twin brother again. I said, Marcus, you said, this is crazy. How all this time you've been lying to me and you haven't told me this. Why would you do that? And he just said,
okay, Alex, I know that you're angry with me. I know that you're confused and I know that you feel that I've betrayed you and lied to you, but I did it to protect you. I had a choice and I wanted to give you a better childhood. I wanted you to have a normal teenage life, and the only way I could do that was to give you a different childhood. And I did it for you and I did it out of love, and I would do it again if I had been in the same situation.
After the initial shock of finding all this out, my mind does calm down, and then I just come to the realisation that he has done this out of love, and I don't have any animosity to him.
Alex, put yourself in your brother's shoes. What do you think those reasons were?
Interesting you asked that. I think he did it for two reasons. One, that it was just too much information to give me at that time when I wasn't capable of learning it. And secondly, I think it gave him a route out of the craziness that was happening around him, and some way for him to actually put that in a box and leave it there so that he could also almost believe the life that he'd given me and have it himself.
I think the point is that if we'd gone through that without this accident and without Alex losing his memory, we would have been focusing a lot more on the abuse and what had happened to us and being negative. And really, we had to be positive the whole time. So, you know, we'd go to my mum's birthday party and we'd make everything fun and make everything nice purely for Alex, which in a way placated the situation for me as well.
Marcus, you are hiding the truth to protect your brother. What did you think would happen if he found out?
Yeah, I played out that he would never forgive me, that we would lose our connection, we would lose our love for each other. And it did for a very, very quick period of time. But I guess that I hadn't really estimated quite how strong our brotherly love and our twinship is. It's almost as if we are one person in that sense.
That's pretty good. No, I don't know what I can add to that, really.
Thank you so much, Alex and Marcus Lewis, for sharing your story. To hear more about their experience, they've got a book, Tell Me Who I Am. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Davey Kim. When Snap Judgment returns, we're lost at home and lost in the woods. We're going to need someone to help us find our way. That's from Snap Judgment. The guide episode continues. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Snap. If you're looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the weekly news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.
Welcome back to Stamp Judgment, the guide episode. Today, we're featuring stories from real people leading other people through the dark woods. And our next story features a real forest and a real guide, and at least that much is real.
Can you tell me what you ate for breakfast?
I had 4 raw eggs and 5 flapjacks with some espresso with a shot of whiskey in it.
You're one of the most disgusting people I know.
That's what I have for breakfast.
What's your name?
Ben Becker.
Tell me just something about yourself.
I'm 29 and living in Boulder, Colorado for going on my third year and trying to train to withstand anything. This is a weird story. You ready?
Yeah. How true is this? Scale 1 to 10.
Scale of 1 to 10, 8.
Okay.
All right. I was living in Pumpkin Town, South Carolina. Real place. And the flea market every Wednesday, everybody called the Jockey Lot. You could buy assault rifles there. I was living in a cabin with the dirtiest hound dog you have ever seen. And I was running this guiding outfitter. And, a really good friend of mine, Brett, he lived in Pumpkin Town too. But he ran an outfitter store, you know, sold camping supplies, stuff like that. And it wasn't doing too good because of the recession. One time I'm hanging out there in the store and I get this call from my lead guide. And he says, "Hey man, we're having trouble with this kid. Can you come out tonight and talk to him? I might have to kick this kid off the course." And I'd kick kids off courses and, you know, always done like the right soft skills talk to him. But I was just kind of burnt out. So Brett's like, "Let me come with you." And I go, "All right." And he goes, "I got an idea." We get in my work truck. And before we go, he goes into his trash can and throws this bag in the back of the truck. And I go, "What's that?" He goes, "Don't worry about it." We run over to his house and we cut out a perfect replica of, you know, whatever, Bigfoot. We cut out a Sasquatch foot. It was big. It was about 3 feet. No, not 3 feet. Probably 2.5. 2.5 feet long. It was big.
It's a big Sasquatch.
Yeah, it was big.
By Sasquatch standards.
So we drive out to up the mountain, and then we drive 9 miles in the motorboat out to where they're camped. And we get out there. It's pretty late, and all the kids are asleep, but my staff's still up. And he was like, "Man, this kid's just been giving me a hard time." He goes into the story, and I go, "Don't worry about it. We got an idea." And so we take the feet, and we make these marks all around the kid's tent. And then Brett gets the bag that he threw in the truck, and it's filled with dog ish. And he pours it out right by where the kid's head is on the outside of the tent. And then we camped out. And in the morning, we wake up and we're out there. And the kid is awake. And he's not freaking out like I thought he'd be freaking out. Instead, he has this look on his face of like sheer awe. He's telling us all these statistics about Sasquatch. And he's like,
"Oh my God, size of this foot. I wish I had some plaster of Paris. I could make a mold because this is definitely an alpha species. This is definitely alpha. I've never seen it this big. Oh my God, I'm freaking out."
And he, like, for the rest of the trip, he's just geeking out on the Sasquatch.
"They've never been seen this far south. Oh my God."
So for every trip, they take pictures and then they do this big picture DVD. At the end of the trip, we're in our pavilion at the base camp. We're showing it, and then the Sasquatch feet show up, and the kids freaking out, and the poop, and everything. And I look at the kid's dad, and he starts geeking out too. And they're just like talking to each other like these little bees. They're just like,
blah, blah, blah.
His dad goes,
"Can you give me a topographical sighting of where this is? I need longitude, latitude, I need GPS coordinates, and I also need a place to get gear."
And I get this call from Brett later that night. He goes,
"Did you send some guy here to me for the Bigfoot thing?" "Oh, yeah, it's the kid's dad." "The guy spent $1,200 on gear. He bought GPS systems. He bought the most powerful scope I have."
And I was like, "Well, great sale. Awesome. Cool." I come over for dinner. He takes me back down into his shop, and he has all these pelts and skins out in his wife's, Susanna's, sewing machine with this huge needle on it. And he goes,
"We're making a Bigfoot costume."
He goes,
"You, me, and Susanna know about this. No one else."
So she helps us out because she's actually quite the seamstress. And we make this thing, and it took us about 8 hours all night. Tons of coffee. It had cigar burns on it. It had tobacco juice on it. It was disgusting. And it was tailor-made to me. Up close, it was pretty bad.
Like, how so? Like, what was the...
You just saw the seams and, like, it, the different colors, the different pelts, because it was, like, made of four different animals. It was, like, black bear, deer, elk, and something, like, rodents, like rabbits and shit. And if you saw me from 30 yards away in the shadows, it was Bigfoot. And so the next morning we get up real early and, you know, we eat breakfast and he's like, let's try it out. So we go to this place called Twin Falls and it's a beautiful place. But the coolest thing about it is you can access the top. It's about 60 feet tall, 70 feet tall. You can access the top and everybody else is down below. So I get up there early in the morning and I get to the top of the falls and I kind of stand up and I look over and it takes about 2 minutes. And then someone screams, and they go, oh my God, it's Bigfoot! And I make this, like, surprise motion, and I go like this. I was like, and then I vanish. And then Brett picks me up down the road on an access trail. Then we do, like, two or three more that morning, like, on different trails.
Oh my God, it's Bigfoot!
Can I interrupt you here?
Yeah.
Did you ever worry about getting shot?
We'll get to that. So, we know a couple other trails where people go in early in the morning and I do a Bigfoot drive, like run by. Just like, you know, just run by and I'm gone. And we put some tracks out. And then we go hang out at a shop and some people, there's some words going around, like people are talking. And so Brett's like, yeah, I saw him last week here. And he has this new map up with some dots and he gets some blurry pictures of me from like his backyard and stuff like that. And we put them up. So a couple weeks go by and he's making some big sales and he even takes a group of family out to go for a Bigfoot sighting and I do a thing.
They're a con artist.
Totally. This whole thing's going down and our friend Curtis, who lives on top of this mountain with the most untrained dog in the world named Motley Crue John Bon Jovi, it dug holes everywhere, it peed inside, it was a disgusting dog. Curtis comes in once he hears about it and he's freaking out. He's like,
oh my God, Bigfoot.
And Curtis lived off of cigarettes, Red Bull, ice cream, and homemade things he made. After about 2 weeks, he comes in one day with this big box of jars, mason jars, with this liquid inside, and he goes,
check it out. I'm gonna make some money on this Sasquatch thing, too.
And he puts it down on Brett's thing, and he goes,
can I sell this here?
And pulls out one of the jars, and it looks like a milky orange paste with chunks in it. It tasted like if you boiled up milkweed and put chili peppers and mashed carrots was pretty much how it tasted. It wasn't that good.
It's Quatch sauce. It's Sasquatch split up and flipped. Quatch sauce. Sasquatch. It's hot sauce made from real Sasquatch juice.
Quatch
sauce. And no one bought the Well, it started to get really crowded out there, and I thought, you know what, maybe I'll do, like, just a couple more, and then it'll be over, because I was afraid someone was going to put a bear trap out, and so I go to the Twin Falls one last time, the place to see Bigfoot, early in the morning, and it's, like, misty, and it's beautiful, and the waterfall's going, and I'm at the top, and I splash in, and there's a bunch of people down there with scopes and lights, and I look over, and
it's Bigfoot!
And I go, and I start backing up, and I'm backing up, and then I hear it behind me, the shotgun. And I turn, and there's Curtis staring me down with a shotgun.
Oh my God, Bigfoot.
And it's early morning, bad lighting, and he's like about 15 yards away. And he goes,
I'm gonna kill you, son of a bitch.
And right before he fired, out of nowhere, Motley Crue John Bon Jovi comes out of the woods
in the air.
No.
Gets me by the head, like full force, this 80-pound dog, and wrestles me to the ground and starts pulling on the top of the mask. And I'm like, damn it, get this dog off me, Curtis. Motley Crue, John Bon Jovi, like, rips it off. It comes off. Curtis still has his gun pointed at me, and I see this look on his face, and it's just sheer disappointment. It's just really let down. This is how he looks. And he goes,
it was you all the time. That's pretty smart. Brett's been making a lot of money.
And then he kind of helps me up. I look down, Motley Crue, John Bon Jovi's tearing my mask to shreds. And we hear like all this hubbub down below. And he helps me out of my Bigfoot suit. And we wad it up and put it in my backpack. And we start getting out of the way before anybody can hike up there. And he's like got his arm off my shoulder. And he's just chuckling. He's like,
son of a, I almost shot you, man. Yeah, that was good looking suit.
There's no more Bigfoot sightings, but the maps are still there, and you know, every once in a while they get together after hours and drink beers and talk about the time they saw Sasquatch. And Curtis, he knows, but he tells this story about how he had me in his sights. Like, he tells it, Motley Crue got me, and I like kicked his dog real hard with my Bigfoot and ran off. And he's like,
I had a shot, but then my damn dog got away, and I would have been millionaire.
Listen, I can absolutely verify that Pumpkinhead is a real place. Everything else, I wouldn't cite it in a term paper. That piece was brought to us by Jeff Impman, the guy behind the amazing podcast There Be Monsters. I highly recommend it. Subscribe, get it on iTunes for free, get it wherever else you can for free. Just get it and understand this. When we return, we're going to pick our own mother. That's right. Pick a mom. On Snap Judgment, the guide episode continues. Stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Thanks again for listening to Snap. Remember to check out the rest of the NPR podcast family, like TED Radio Hour, IQ2, or State of the Reunion. You can find them and many more on iTunes under NPR Podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the guide episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're following behind those people that lead the way. And if we're very, very lucky, we have someone there to hold our hand through life transitions. But if we're not so fortunate to already have someone, we may just have to go looking.
Carmen was 8 years old when her mom, Evelyn, delivered the news.
I remember I came home from school. She told me she had to talk to me about something. And then she explained to me that she was sick, that she's probably going to get really sick and she's going to be in and out of the hospital, and that, you know, some things might change. I know that I had heard about it before. I had heard what AIDS was, and I broke down. Like, I started crying, and I ran to my room, and I wanted to be left alone. And I was just thinking that if I didn't face it, it would just go away. Go away or disappear or somehow be fixed.
But with her mom going in and out of the hospital and getting weaker by the day, Carmen couldn't ignore it anymore. By the time she was 11, she started to accept the fact that her mom, the only parent she had, was going to pass away.
I was scared. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I couldn't imagine her not being there.
Carmen was still a kid and wasn't exactly sure how to express all these feelings. And she still held out hope that her mom would get better. But then one day, when they were in their living room,
she was laying in bed and I had went over to go talk to her. And I was sitting next to her and I was holding her hand. I had never seen her in this state where she was just completely, it's almost as if she was lifeless and she was still here. That's when it really hit me that it was time to find someone else to take care of me. And
Carmen looked up at her mom and asked,
"Mom, who's gonna take care of me?" It seemed like she was tearing up a little bit, even though she didn't cry. But I remember her telling me, "Don't worry about it, that we were gonna find somebody really great."
Right then and there, they decided to do something rather unusual. They were going to find Carmen a new mom, together. And in a situation like this, you would still expect for the mom to make all the decisions, right? Not in this case. It was Carmen's idea after all, so she was going to get to choose her new mom. Carmen's mom contacted an adoption agency, she set up appointments, but it was her 11-year-old who asked the questions.
The two questions that I always asked were, do you like animals and do you believe in God?
When they met the first candidate,
my mom was in the hospital. I was by her bedside. The woman came in. She was wearing like a nice suit and stuff. She looked very presentable and stuff like that. One of the first questions I asked her was, do you like animals? And the woman kind of just turned up her face and she said, no, I don't like animals. So I had asked the woman if she could please leave the room. That's when I told my mom that this woman wasn't the one, that I didn't like her.
It went on like this for months. One woman wasn't warm enough. One didn't believe in God. Another one changed her mind and backed out. There was one couple from Massachusetts that did look promising. Carmen and her mom even visited them at their home. But when Carmen's mom suddenly fell ill and had to be rushed to the hospital, the couple wouldn't let Carmen visit her.
All these thoughts crossed my mind, like, you know, when she's actually dying and stuff like that, these people are going to try to keep me away from my mom. Of course, I realized that those weren't the people that I wanted to go stay with.
Then they found Susan, and it seemed like the perfect fit. Susan was a single mom with a little boy named Jeremy. She was a social worker who'd always wanted to adopt a little girl.
And I remember Susan coming to the house. She brought her little boy with her. His name was Jeremy. And just her personality, she seemed very warm, very loving, you know? Very kind of mother-like.
They started slow. A lunch date here, a movie date there. And eventually, Carmen's mom wanted her to stay over at Susan's on the weekends to sort of test run her new family. But at first, Carmen was terrified to leave her mom alone. What if she got sick or had to go to the hospital?
I was a little frightened and I was scared, and I would actually call my mom up, like, I mean, several times a day. You know, as soon as I got there, I would call her. And then a couple of hours would pass and I would call her again.
But Carmen wasn't just worried about her mom's health. She was feeling kind of guilty, too.
There was a sense of maybe feeling like, am I doing something wrong by looking for someone else? Like, I don't want to lose that connection with my mom in the process of trying to look for someone else, you know?
But as the weeks went by and Carmen started to get a real picture of what her life might be like with Susan, she relaxed.
After I actually settled in at their house and, you know, they actually made a bedroom space for me and everything, I started enjoying the time with Susan, and I felt in a sense that I kind of like belonged there, like I matched up very well with them. You know, and her son even like kind of had some of the same physical characteristics that I had, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes. And then as a couple of weekends went by, I started calling my mom less and less. You know, there were moments where where I finally was able to be a kid again, and I completely forgot, you know, my mom was so sick. You know, I would forget that that these are the things that I'm dealing with in my life.
After 2 months, the arrangement was working so well that Carmen, her mom, and Susan decided to take the next big step. They signed the legal guardianship papers and celebrated with cake after. Carmen officially had a new mom. But then one weekend, Carmen didn't want to go to Susan's because her mom wasn't feeling well. Her mom insisted.
And then on Sunday afternoon, I got a call from my mom. She said that she was back in the hospital. And I remember being on the couch with the phone in my hand, and I started crying hysterically. Susan came over to me. She was trying to console me and everything like that. And then my mom was telling me that I'd probably have to, you know, stay there a couple of extra days or something like that. Jeremy kept on bothering me and bothering me to want to play. And I guess he was being a regular 3 or 4 year old. I forget how old he was exactly. And Susan was trying to actually, like, make me play with him. And she told me, you know, this is going to be your little brother. You really need to go play with him. And I think that's when things really started getting, when things took a little turn for the worst. Even though I had previously felt like I was part of the family, I felt as if her son's feelings were just the main important thing, and that mine didn't matter, and I felt like I didn't belong there anymore.
Susan called Carmen's mom at the hospital later that night, telling her that Carmen was refusing to play with Jeremy. And suddenly, the two moms were at odds with one another, each one fiercely defending her own kid. They had a blow-up. A couple of days went by. Carmen's mom was released from the hospital, Carmen got to go home, and then Susan called.
With Susan kind of pressing the issue about how my mom needs to speak to me, that I can't do things like that, and that this is going to be my little brother, that I should give him attention and play with him.
A few days went by and Susan called again, but each mom kept holding her ground.
I actually overheard a conversation on the phone with my mom telling her, you know, that it wasn't fair for her to expect me to want to start playing around with her son if I just found out she was in the hospital, and telling her that this is just something she's going to have to deal with or not deal with.
What started off as a petty fight over whose child was right was now turning into a discussion about something else.
My mom had the fear of Susan always feeling that her son is right or her son's needs have to be met before my needs, you know, and not putting us both on the same level because that was her biological son and I'm not, you know, her biological daughter. And that's what really brought my mom over the edge. My mom just told Susan, like, you know what, maybe you're not the person to take care of my daughter.
And like that, the whole arrangement fell apart. The co-parenting, Susan's legal guardianship, everything. Carmen never saw Susan again. And maybe Susan wasn't sure how to balance her son's needs with Carmen's. Evelyn probably wasn't ready to let her daughter go. Carmen, she went back to spending the weekends with her mom. And then 8 months later,
she had slipped into a coma. I was sitting next to her and I was holding her hand and she had just stopped breathing. It kind of like really hit me, like, oh, she's really gone. Like, she can't talk to me. She's, you know, I saw her there, but she was just completely gone. You know, and I just remember sitting by her for like a really long time and I didn't move.
The moment she feared had come, a life without her mom. With all their planning to make this easier, time had run out.
You know, I'm not sure if we would have had more time to actually even find someone else, if I would have felt any different about them. I didn't want anybody else to take care of me. You know, I wanted her to take care of me. This was the only parent that I knew, and me and my mom had such a close relationship. So the idea of somebody else, you know, stepping into that position wasn't something that I really wanted to happen.
Carmen went from staying with a family friend to living in a residential facility run by the state. At the age of 16, she ran away, got a job, and struck out on her own. Turns out, there was no replacement.
It seemed like there was always something that I was going to find wrong with someone. No one was ever going to measure up to my mom.
Carmen Mirach, is currently studying to be a nurse. Much love to Carmen from SNAP, and thank you so much for sharing your story. That piece was produced by Nancy Lopez, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Now, you've been guided to the end of the hour, but not the end of the relationship. Full SNAP episodes, pictures, movies, podcasts, they all await your pleasure right now at snapjudgment.org. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the noisiest crew ever to chase a Bigfoot. May I please introduce the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He won't sell his beats to Apple for $1 billion. Pat was C.D. Miller. Anna Sussman likes Applejacks. Julie DeWitt digs Wheaties. Joe Rosenberg, Captain Crunches. They call him Davey Honeycomb Kim. Nancy Kicks Lopez. Renzo, the Rice Krispie Goryeo. Leon, Count Chocula Morimoto. Jasmine, the Fruit Loop Aguilera. And Willabina likes oatmeal. Do you ever accidentally pour cream on your cereal and then just eat it that way anyway? It happens all the time to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but much love to the CPB. Did you ever accidentally pour water on your cereal and just eat like that anyway? It happens all the time to PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago can't be WBEZ in Chicago. You may have put two and two together and determined that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could run through the woods in a Bigfoot costume, holding a hot dog slathered in quatch sauce, and you would still, even then, not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.